The headlines. Iran's president says that his country's fundamental policies will not change, no matter who becomes the next U.S. president.
It is up to the U.S. government to align itself with these policies or distance itself from them.
Thousands of Armenians rally in the capital Yerevan, demanding the resignation of the country's premier over the recent ceasefire deal with Azerbaijan. Plus, local Saudi officials say a blast at the World War I cemetery in the city of Jeddah has left two people injured. Well, welcome to our studios here in the capital, Tehran. This is News. Thanks for joining us. The Iranian president says that his country's fundamental policies will not change, no matter who becomes the next U.S. president.
Our policies will not change. The Islamic Republic of Iran will pursue the same policy it has had so far. It is up to the U.S. government to align itself with these policies or distance itself from them. The administration of the outgoing U.S. president chose to distance itself from our policies. We wanted to fight terrorism, but they wanted to support it. We wanted regional nations to be free and independent, but the U.S. wanted to interfere in their affairs. We wanted peace and stability in the region, but they sought to continue war and sell weapons in the region.
President Rouhani said Iran's policy is based on respect for other nations and non-interference in their affairs. He said the country wants constructive interaction with the world and seeks to fight terrorism and end unilateralism. Rouhani said one of the reasons that incumbent Donald Trump failed to win the U.S. presidential election was that his administration was humiliated at the U.N. Security Council. That, Rouhani added, happened after Washington's anti-Tehran proposal was rejected outright by the Security Council's members. Iran's president said another reason that Trump lost was his mismanagement in the handling of the COVID-19 pandemic. Journalist and commentator Hossein Mohsen Abbas says U.S. President Donald Trump has made many mistakes leading to his policy failures.
It's very hard to say which factor actually brought down Donald Trump. He made so many mistakes this year in terms of COVID-19. The way he handled that was abysmal. But he didn't have any foreign policy success, although he didn't go to war in any new countries. He certainly tried regime change, psychological operations, the assassination of a diplomatic mission, which Commander Soleimani was obviously the main victim. So he carried out hugely dangerous acts, which could have caused wars, world wars potentially as well. And his, if you like, irrational behavior certainly wasn't one even his partners in Europe could actually predict or were comfortable with. In fact, that's why most of the leaders, who his erstwhile colleagues, if you like, or allies, have been quick to congratulate Biden, even though the election is still being disputed in many ways. However, coming back to the Iranian region, will maximum pressure be lifted? This is the biggest issue. Can Biden commit to preventing the economic terrorism, which America has initiated long before Trump was in office, on Iran? Will the economic sanctions be reversed? Will Israeli expansionism be prevented? Is Iran going to be allowed to have ballistic missile programs? Because, you know, the American administration has been after that, and that's been in addition to the JCPOA negation or unilateral withdrawal by America.
The row over the recently held presidential election in the U.S. continues amid harsh rhetoric over the vote outcome that gives Democratic candidate Joe Biden a clean sweep. Speaking to Fox News on Tuesday, the White House press secretary claimed to be holding more than 200 pages of affidavits proving voter fraud. Kayleigh McEnany said that these frauds include dead people voting as well as some casting their ballots multiple times. Meanwhile, the New York Times reported that no evidence of voter fraud or other irregularities have been found in any states. U.S. media have projected Biden a clear winner in the race, but incumbent President Donald Trump has refused to concede. Trump says that he is the legal winner and claims that he is being cheated out of victory. He has launched a slew of lawsuits to overturn the result. Thousands of Armenians have once again taken to the streets, demanding the resignation of Prime Minister Nikol Pashinyan over his signing of a ceasefire agreement with Azerbaijan. Protesters defied a martial law ban on street rallies in the capital Yerevan. They chanted slogans like, "Nikol is a traitor." The new rally comes a day after protesters stormed and ransacked some government buildings. Tensions prevail across Armenia after Moscow brokered truce ended about 6 weeks of fighting between Baku and Yerevan over the disputed Nagorno-Karabakh region. Under the deal, Azerbaijan will keep all of its territorial gains, while Armenian forces will hand over control of several territories that they captured recently. Some 2,000 Russian peacekeepers are also deployed to the region to uphold the truce. The agreement sparked anger in Armenia, but celebrations in Azerbaijan. The blast at a World War I cemetery in the Saudi city of Jeddah has left at least 2 people injured. Saudi authorities say the explosion happened during a remembrance ceremony where diplomats from several countries had gathered. They say that a Greek national and a Saudi security officer were wounded. Security services have launched an investigation. The French Foreign Ministry has denounced the attack, asking French citizens in Jeddah to avoid gatherings and stay cautious when moving around. The Saudi state TV says local authorities have secured the blast site and traffic flow is normal in the surrounding area. Time now for the news review of this bulletin. Hello, welcome to the news review. In aid to Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas has condemned the visit by an Israeli settlers delegation to the United Arab Emirates as part of the normalization deal between Tel Aviv and Abu Dhabi. Abu Shah said that it was, quote, painful to witness Arab cooperation with one of the worst manifestations of aggression against the Palestinian people. This after the Israeli delegation met with Emirati business people to discuss commercial opportunities there. The UAE and Bahrain signed U.S. broker deals aimed at normalizing ties with the Israeli regime in mid-September. The moves have drawn widespread condemnations from the Muslim world as well as Palestinians. The Palestinians call the agreements a betrayal of their cause and a stab in their back. Joining us from Ankara, Ramallah is Mona Kandil, and we also have with us Osama Nazal, who's a manager at the Palestine Broadcast International, also joining us from Ankara, Ramallah. Okay, Mona Kandil, first over to you. Tell us more about this visit by this delegation from the UAE and what it signifies and how it's, I guess, received also in the occupied territories.
Well, this delegation includes Israeli officials from Israeli settlement. It was the visit aimed to meet Emirati business people to discuss commercial opportunities, according to the Israeli media, following the United Arab Emirates establishing the formal ties with Israel. The visit, of course, angered the Palestinians because it's the first step such a visit would allow more Israeli settlers and more Israeli businessmen to fly from Tel Aviv to these Arab cities and like Dubai. This angered the Palestinians because they believe it's not like what the Arab Gulf states claim. It's for the sake of the Palestinian cause and for achieving peace. Every day it's becoming more clearer that the agreement that was signed by Bahrain and United Arab Emirates with Israel is only to serve these countries' interests and not the Palestinians. By the way, Israel today revealed that there will be three flights from Tel Aviv directly to Dubai in December, including direct flights. The well-known Israeli company El Al will be traveling directly, taking Israelis from Tel Aviv to United Arab Emirates.
Okay, so Osama Nazal, when you take a look at this normalization, first of all, it just was something to bring out to the open because we know that behind the scenes, this normalization occurred quite a while ago, some time ago. But overall, it's the Palestinian cause that is not being paid attention to and is somewhat being shoved aside. Why do you think the UAE has taken this step, along with Israel, to do this?
First of all, thank you very much for hosting me. Really, first, when we talk about the Arab governments like United Arab Emirates, Bahrain, and Sudan normalization with the Israeli occupation government, we reject that as a matter of a principle because we know that the Palestinian cause, a strategic debt, is the Arab and Islamic countries and peoples. So from the beginning, the Palestinian position was clear that we reject all these forms of normalization, and they are neither in the favor of the Palestinian people, not in the favor of the people of the United Arab Emirates, Bahrain or Sudan, because we know what the Zionist project is all about. Israel has one theory, and it implements this theory on the ground every day, every month, every year. More colonization, more grab of land, and more domination not only over the Palestinians, but the Middle East in general. Israel wants to have like a security base in the Gulf in order to implement its, if it is possible to call security scheme, colonial scheme, whatever, and it is using the United Arab Emirates and the other countries that normalize relation with it. Really, it is very painful, and it was not expected at all to see an Arab country welcoming Israeli colonists, Israeli settlers. And this is not only a blow to the Palestinian people. It is a blow to the international law. It is a blow to the United Nations. It is a blow to all the free world that rejects Israeli colonialism and the Israeli occupation of the Palestinian territories. You know that there are hundreds of United Nations resolutions and the Security Council that consider the Israeli colonial settlements in the Palestinian territory as illegal and illegitimate. And it is not allowed for any country to deal with these settlements as if they were normal and legal. So the first point that United Arab Emirates gets is the violation of the United Nations resolutions and of the international law and of the Arab principles and the Arab and Islamic countries' fundamentals. United Arab Emirates is opening its country and the resources of its people, the economies of its people, for the colonial state of Israel. It's really very painful and it's very deplorable. This is what I can say about this.
Mona Kandil, if you can tell us in conclusion, some time has now passed by since the deal, normalization deal, has been announced. How have Palestinians reacted to it? Because many are saying that within the Arab world that the Arab people are very much disappointed over the governments that have announced the normalization, like the people in Bahrain and also people within the UAE perhaps.
That's right, because when the agreement was signed, Palestinians held demonstrations and protests, and they were chanting against the Bahrain government and the UAE government as well, saying that the people, if they have the decision, the ability to decide, they will not, of course, allow their leaders to sign the normalization agreements with the enemy. And also demonstrations were held in these countries as well. So they are slamming the leaders of these countries, not the people, knowing if it's them to decide. They will be continue supporting the Palestinians, their cause, and Jerusalem, Al-Quds. And if they have the chance, of course, they will come and fight with them the Israeli occupation.
Thank you for that. That's Mona Kandil from Ramallah, and also thank you, Osama Nazel, who's the manager at Palestine Broadcast International, also from occupied Ramallah. And that does it for the news review. Thanks for tuning in. Welcome back. Bahrain's longest-serving Prime Minister, Prince Khalifa bin Salman Al Khalifa, has died at the age of 84. According to Bahrain's official news agency, Khalifa died at the Mayo Clinic Hospital in the U.S. The reason for his death has not been announced yet. Reports say the specific number of royal families will attend the burial ceremony once the body is repatriated. The kingdom has declared a week of national mourning. Khalifa took office one day after Bahrain declared independence from Britain in 1971. He was widely criticized for defending dynastic rule and his authoritarian response to the 2011 mass uprising against the Al-Khalifa regime. Russia says interim trial results show that a Sputnik V vaccine has been 92% effective in preventing the spread of COVID-19. The Russian Direct Investment Fund said the results are based on data from the first 16,000 trial participants who received both shots of the two-dose vaccine. They added that there were no serious side effects during the trials of the vaccine. The announcement came as Moscow is trying to keep pace with Western drug makers in the race for COVID-19 treatment. On Monday, Germany's BioNTech and U.S.'s Pfizer also announced their successful trial of a vaccine which they claimed was more than 90% effective. New developments come as the coronavirus continues to wreak havoc with over 50 million cases and 1.2 million deaths globally. The coronavirus continues to spread in Iran, with the country reporting its highest daily fatalities and infections since the pandemic began there in mid-February. The Iranian Health Ministry recorded 462 deaths in 24 hours, pushing the overall fatalities to more than 39,000. Over 11,700 people also tested positive for the disease during the same period. That was also an all-time high. Iran has registered over 715,000 cases so far. 27 of the country's 31 provinces are either in the red zone or in an alarming state based on the coronavirus scaling system. The government has already announced new restrictions across the country to curb the spread of the virus. The foreign ministers of Iran and Pakistan have expressed deep concern about the rising Islamophobia in the West. During a meeting in Islamabad, Mohammad Jawad Zarif and Shah Mahmood Qureshi said insulting Muslim sanctities under the pretext of freedom of expression is unacceptable. The reaction came amid a backlash against French President Emmanuel Macron's support for sacrilegious cartoons of the Prophet Muhammad, as well as his recent Islamophobic comments. Elsewhere in the remarks, the top Iranian and Pakistani diplomats also called for boosting ties between their countries to achieve regional peace. Javed Rana is our correspondent joining us from Islamabad. Tell us more about this visit and the highlights, if you may.
Well, apart from the consensus of the both countries on Islamophobia, particularly in the Europe and more focused it was on France, both countries have the similar views when it comes to Islamophobia, and particularly when this recent wave has erupted. But more specifically, the focus of the both countries during the discussion was on the border management and the crisis of peace in Afghanistan. And the Iranian foreign minister sounded very satisfied. He said he's very satisfied with the kind of the response that he has got from Pakistan on the border management. You may recall in the past there have been back and forth militant attacks and militant movements on shared borders between Pakistan and Iran. And another very important issue was the future of the Afghan peace deal. After the U.S. Controversial elections, the scene remains unclear. Now, since Joe Biden is most likely to take over the charge of the U.S. in January, so there are apprehensions which have been shared between both countries that what is going to be the fate of the peace deal. Because under Donald Trump, the withdrawal of the American troops, all troops, was very much certain. And under Joe Biden, nobody knows what is going to happen, because that particular peace deal still carries clauses which can be have some sort of manipulated interpretation through which the U.S. could possibly prolong its stay. But at the back end, everybody knows that prolonging American forces in Afghanistan is not that easy, given the fact that the Americans have already lost war over there. I think those concerns were shared by both countries, and both countries have a very genuine concern on the militancy inside Afghanistan. On Afghanistan soil, the Daesh has been projected behind the scene, according to Iran, by the Americans, and similar concerns have been expressed by the Russia. And Pakistan has its own concern that some militants are being sponsored by India inside Afghanistan, who are conducting terrorist attack in the north and southwest of Pakistan. I think both foreign ministers believe that they need to have more frequent interaction on how to handle that kind of crisis. But certainly, both
Well, it looks like we lost Javed Rana there at the end. That was a correspondent, Javed Rana, there from Islamabad. And that does it for this edition of World News. Bye-bye for now.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable Discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio. Amir Kabir. Khayyam. Maulana. Avicenna. Khwarizmi. Iranian notables, sources of global honor.
In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. Dear listeners, in this episode, you will get familiar with the Iranian poet who lived in 7th and 8th centuries AH, corresponding to 13th and 14th centuries AD. He was Seyf Faraghani. Seyf Faraghani has been known as a leader of socio-political poetry in Farsi language. The 7th and 8th centuries AH were among the bright eras of Iran's literary history, as masters of poetry and Gnosticism like Maulana, Sa'di, and Hafez lived in that era. We said there is little known about the life and times of Saifuddin Abul Mohammed Muhammad Faraghani. Dr. Zabiullah Safa, who has edited his Divan or collection of poems, writes in the introduction, "Our whole information about him is restricted to the Divan of poems that has remained for us. As there is name or trace mentioned in the literary references and sources of this able poet, although he had a high status in expression of mystic concepts and, certainly, has been one of the leaders of Khanqah, there is no trace of him in the Farsi books of the great figures of mysticism and Gnosticism." You heard that Saifuddin Mohammed Muhammad Faraghani was born in Transoxiana and left his town Farghane for Asia Minor, current Turkey, in youth. He lived the rest of his life in Aksaray, a small town of the region. This episode will be mostly dedicated to explanation of the era of Mongol onslaught. The Mongol onslaught that had been started by Genghis Khan ended by Timur's rule in Iran. The era of his rule was very tumultuous and resulted in widespread devastation of the Iranian plateau. Although this period was very destructive and bloody for Iran, the men of letters and poets did their best in safeguarding the injured culture and literature amid all disasters. Iran was a subordinate of the Mongol Empire in those days. Even after the end of Mongol era, Iran was ruled by his grandchildren. However, after the termination of their rule, a few kings and rulers came to power in Iran who were weak and incompetent. Thus, the ground was set for Tamerlane's dominance over the country. Historical books have given the details of Genghis Khan's massacres and crimes in detail. In the book of Jahangoshay Jovani, we read, after the arrival of Changi's troops in the city of Marv, they started looting, raping, and shedding the blood of innocent people. They continued their crimes for 4 years. They separated women from men, captivated 400 men in various professions, and girls and boys, and killed the rest of the people. The book makes it clear that each of the Mongol soldiers killed over 300 people of Marv. It is said that more than 1.3 million people were massacred. The cruel massacre of people by Mongols swept across all cities and villages that they assaulted. Many simple-minded people believed that Genghis Khan was the scourge of God. Genghis Khan himself also believed that he was the scourge of God unto the sinners. After capturing the city of Bukhara, the rich and merchants of the city were brought to him. He told them, "O people, you should know that you have committed big sins. I am God's punishment. Had you not committed big sins, God would have not sent me to punish you." Unfortunately, most of the attacks of the Mongols would face little resistance, as the rulers and kings were not popular and mostly thought of their throne rather than the lives of people. For example, the forces of Muhammad Khwarazm Shah fled the city of Balkh after just 3 days of fighting. The result of the Mongol invasion was a very weak rule and a decadent society. The whole social and economic structure was destroyed, and corruption was rampant everywhere. There was no order in the social system of the country, and an inexperienced group of rulers and ministers took the helm of power. Most of these people maintained that the only way of salvation and prosperity was absolute obeisance to the Mongols. Therefore, Mongol beliefs and traditions such as superstition and a belief in vicious ghosts and sorcery prevailed everywhere. Dear listeners, next time we will continue the discussion. Till then, God bless.
This is A to Z. An introduction to Islamic lifestyle. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the Most Beneficent, the Most Merciful. Dear brothers and sisters, Assalamu alaikum. Peace and blessings of Allah be upon you all. This is A to Z, coming to you from IRIB English Radio, and I'm your host, Ali. This radio show is about Islamic lifestyle, and in each episode, we will be talking about a different lesson. Please stay with us till the end of today's program. Today's lesson, politeness with polite words. Brothers and sisters, one of the ways to make your speech and your interaction polite with other people is through the use of polite words. Now, every language has these words in them here and there. Some cultures use them more, the other cultures, they use them a little less, but nevertheless, these words are there. these words and adding them to your sentence, starting your sentence with these words or ending your sentence with these words, it makes a huge difference. Your communication and your interaction and your speech with other people is going to change with these words if we get accustomed to using these words. This is how the human society works. So for instance, you know, start your conversation with a salam. You know, salamu alaikum. Assalamu alaikum. You know, you walk into a store, you go talk to, you know, office manager or something. You start with salam. You know, all of a sudden, you're sending across a message of politeness and you're sending across a message of peace and salama. Then, jazakallah, or thank you, you know, jazakallah, may Allah reward you, you know, thank you. These small little gestures, they make a huge difference. Shukran, or thank you, right? Kindly or please. You are welcome. God bless you. Congratulations. Excuse me. Good luck. Good morning. Nice to meet you. Could you help me? You know, you need help. You could just say, you know, I need this. Can I get this? No. You could start your sentence by saying something like, could you help me, please? Right? And this actually puts the other person in a completely different zone. You know, have a nice day, for instance. Sorry, no problem. May I? You know, these are those keywords. Your vocabulary and sentence structure matters a lot, brothers and sisters. Don't be assertive where you don't have to be. Welcome back to your listeners. We've been discussing politeness in and through polite words. We laid out a few words for you that actually change the speech of yours and interaction of yours and this experience, this mutual experience that you're having with the party that you are communicating or interacting with. These words are those keywords, and there are many others, and all other languages have their own keywords as well. You know, these are the ones just used in English. Now, polite speech serves as a padding between people to prevent conflict. Without the use of polite speech, conflicts like that of guns and biggers are more likely to occur because people feel offended. For this reason, polite speech is an important part of preserving peace within the community and social unity. So, you know, sometimes we think that polite speech is just going to help me as an individual at a very personal individual level. Other times, we have a bigger spectrum that we are looking at, and that's the entire human society, entire human community. When I use polite speech, it, as a matter of fact, gives this encouragement to people around me to start using polite speech as well. And see, it's like very contagious, right? From one person to another person to another, and soon enough you realize that the entire society starts to transform. People are not being mean to each other in their speech, in their gestures. Rather, they're being polite. So it's really about developing and establishing this culture of politeness in the Islamic societies. And humans, all humans can benefit from it. And they feel relaxed. They don't have hypertension. They don't feel headache. You know, they don't really get into fights that often. Why? Because you created this environment of politeness. Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, thank you very much for staying with us till the end of today's episode of A to Z. Don't forget to log on to our website at www.parstoday.com, Call of Islam page. We leave you all in the care of Allah. Till next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thank you.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The number of forcibly displaced persons around the world has increased dramatically, reaching almost 80 million. According to the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, UNHCR, the number of refugees has also gone up from roughly 15 million a decade ago to 26 million today. And 77% of the refugees find themselves in a protracted situation, defined as having remained displaced without a durable solution, such as voluntary return to their home countries following the resolution of conflicts, resettlement, or local integration for more than 5 years. Because of persistent conflicts, only 3.9 million refugees were able to return to their homes between 2010 and 2019. Compared to roughly 10 million between 2000 and 2010, and 15.3 million in the 1990s. Meanwhile, the European Union's new pact for migrants makes little allowance for how the COVID-19 pandemic is going to impact the EU's migration and asylum policies. The pandemic has profoundly affected the capacity of host countries to manage the presence of refugees and ensure their protection. Already fragile health infrastructures are stretched in helping local populations, let alone refugees. The pandemic has also eroded income from trade, tourism, and crucial revenue from remittances. The pact should recognize the dire forced migration picture, the impact of COVID-19, and the associated expected rise in poverty. We have prepared for you an article written jointly by Kemal Kürşi, M. Murat Erdogan, and Nihal Eminoglu, titled EU's New Pact on Migration and Asylum Missing a True Foundation. The article was published on Brookings.edu website. Please stay with us for more. On 23rd of September, the European Commission launched a new Pact on Migration and Asylum, proposing to overhaul the European Union's long-ailing policies in this area. European Union Vice President Margaritis Schinas likened the pact to a building with three floors, comprised of an external dimension centered around strengthened partnerships with countries of origin and transit, robust management of external borders, and firm but fair internal rules. The Commission proposal must still make its way through the legislative process in the European Parliament and the European Council. The problem is, the pact needs a foundational basement in the form of recognizing that an overwhelming majority of the world's refugees are hosted in developing countries. Without a basement, the whole edifice is undermined. The European Union must incorporate policy ideas from the Global Compact on Refugees, GCR, to rectify this. The pact's external dimension, which calls for strengthening partnership with countries of origin and transit in the EU's immediate neighbourhood and beyond, is its ground floor. The second floor relates to policies to fortify and improve the management of the EU's external borders. The third floor proposes rules to resolve the long-standing challenge within the EU to achieve a more balanced distribution of responsibilities and promote solidarity among EU members in dealing with asylum seekers and refugees. At all three levels, the pact has faced intense pushback. With respect to the third floor, the Commission has been criticized for catering to the priorities of the more conservative and anti-immigrant member states such as Hungary, Poland and Slovakia. The pact allows members to opt out from participating in the relocation of asylum seekers and refugees within the EU by offering them the possibility to instead provide administrative and financial support to other member states. Serious doubts have been expressed about the viability of this scheme. On the second floor, the big concern is that, once again, border security has been prioritized over access to asylum. While emphasizing the principle of non-refoulement as enshrined in international refugee law, the pact at the same time introduces measures that are clearly meant to complicate the possibility that individuals fleeing persecution and conflicts can seek to obtain protection in the European Union. A former director of the Centre for Refugee Studies at Oxford University sees these measures as aiming to harden and formalize the fortress Europe. Migrants and refugees were to be kept out of Europe at all costs. The emphasis on protecting Europe's borders becomes most evident at the ground floor. Here the pact calls the revamping partnership with third countries and reflects the European Union's long-standing policy of externalizing the cost and responsibility of managing its external borders. Tying policy issues such as development assistance, trade concessions, security, education, agriculture, and visa facilitation for third country nationals to those countries' willingness to cooperate on migration management has long been criticized as asymmetrical. The pact takes this relationship to a new coercive level by suggesting the possibility of applying restrictive visa measures to third countries unwilling to be cooperative. Time will tell whether these problems on each floor will be addressed as the Commission proposal makes its way through the legislative process. However, there is a deeper structural problem to the pact, resulting from the missing basement. This is because the pact fails to account for two major global realities confronting the European Union. First problem is that the pact is so inward-oriented that it fails to recognize the policy implications of the dire state of forced migration globally. The number of forcibly displaced persons has increased dramatically, reaching almost 80 million individuals. According to the UN High Commissioner for Refugees, UNHCR, the number of refugees alone has gone up from roughly 15 million a decade ago to 26 million today. And 77% of the refugees find themselves in a protracted situation, defined as having remained displaced without a durable solution, such as voluntary return to their home countries following the resolution of conflicts, resettlement, or local integration for more than 5 years. Because of persistent conflicts, only 3.9 million refugees were able to return to their homes between 2010 and 2019, compared to roughly 10 million between 2000 and 2010, and 15.3 million in the 1990s. Secondly, the pact makes little allowance for how the COVID-19 pandemic is going to impact the European Union's migration and asylum policies. The pandemic has profoundly affected the capacity of host countries to manage the presence of refugees and ensure their protection. Already fragile health infrastructures are stretched in helping local populations, let alone refugees. The pandemic has also eroded income from trade, tourism, and crucial revenue from remittances. The pact should recognize the dire forced migration picture, the impact of COVID-19, and the associated expected rise in poverty. The Economist and the United Nations have noted that the pandemic risks undoing the gains made against poverty in the past two decades. According to the World Bank, most affected will be developing countries, where more than 85% of these refugees are hosted. This picture is likely to erode the capacity of these countries to cope with the presence of refugees and manage public resentment as competition for scarce resources between refugees and locals intensifies. Under these circumstances, it would not be unrealistic to expect pressures for secondary movements towards the EU to build up, reminiscent of the ones that occurred during 2015 and 2016. The European Union has an interest in recognizing the reality presented by the basement floor and should supplement policies on the first floor and above accordingly. A former UNHCR official points out the pact hardly makes any reference to the Global Compact on Refugees, GCR, but it could be a so-called inspiring source of policy ideas. The idea of the Global Compact on Refugees emerged from the September 2016 United Nations Summit in New York that was held to address the challenges resulting from the European migration crisis. Adopted in December of 2018, the Global Compact on Refugees recognizes that the traditional refugee protection system based on the 1951 Geneva Convention is under duress, if not broken. Against this reality, it calls on the international community to work together in the spirit of burden and responsibility sharing to improve the self-reliance of refugees and the resilience of their host communities, as well as help hosts transform refugees from being a humanitarian burden to a development and economic opportunity. All European Union member countries, apart from Hungary, have endorsed the GCR. The Global Compact on Refugees. Though the pact fails to acknowledge the GCR, the Global Compact on Refugees, the European Union Vice President Margaritis Schinas promises to seek global solutions and responsibility sharing with international partners on migration, as well as proposes to establish a union resettlement and humanitarian admission framework regulation that would provide a stable EU framework for the European Union contribution to global resettlement efforts. These reflect at least the spirit of the GCR, the Global Compact on Refugees. However, the European Union needs to go beyond this and heed to the Global Compact on Refugees' call to promote economic opportunities, decent work, job creation and entrepreneurship programs for host community members and refugees in refugee hosting countries. Then can the European Union enjoy a solid basement floor for the rest of the pact. The Global Compact on Refugees offers a rich array of innovative policy suggestions that the European Union can take into consideration when negotiating partnerships with countries hosting large numbers of refugees. One such policy idea calls for a more active involvement of the private sector in supporting self-reliance of refugees through decent and sustainable employment. In its partnership agreement, the European Union could include terms incentivizing companies to offer such opportunities for refugees. This could be enabled by extending preferential trade arrangements for countries hosting large numbers of refugees, which is something the Global Compact on Refugees mentions. Such partnerships with the European Union could be conditioned to refugees being offered sustainable employment opportunities. The advantage of all this is that the resulting economic growth would also benefit host communities, support social cohesion, and help empower already fragile economies coming out of the COVID-19-induced economic recession. It would also give the partnerships that the European Union is advocating for at the ground floor of the pact a much more solid foundation based on a cooperative spirit rather than the current formulation. In this way, the new pact would help create a win-win-win outcome, benefiting refugees, benefiting the host countries, and benefiting the EU.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. 49 meters, 6040 kHz for Europe, and 25 meters, 11880 kHz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the Internet. Our Internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is a part of a speech of Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, on the birthday of Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him and his family.
The resistance at the beginning of Bayset resulted in 3 years of unbelievable resistance in Shebe Abi Talib. Children cried through the night out of hunger. The sound of their crying could be heard in Mecca, and some of the kind-hearted disbelievers of Quraysh felt sympathetic towards them, but no one dared to help them due to their fear of the powerful. That was while the faith of the early Muslims, whose children wasted away before their eyes, there were many people who died there. Many were plagued with diseases, and many suffered from starvation, was not shaken. The commander of the faithful, alayhi salam, told his dear son, Muhammad ibn al-Hanafiyya, "The mountains may be shaken, they may be removed, but your faith must not be shaken. That was the same piece of advice that the Holy Prophet, peace be upon him, and his family gave in his testament. That is the way the Islamic Ummah must rise up. That is what the Baysat of the Islamic Ummah means. That is the lesson that the Prophet, peace be upon him, and his family taught us. That is what Baysat teaches us.
Your light and love, all I see, nothing more I'd ever want to need. My Lord, protect me from dishonor, grant me faith to be stronger.
We say that the holy existence of the great Prophet and Messenger of Islam, peace be upon him and his family, is the most important point in creating unity. We have said before that the world of Islam can meet at this point. This is a point where the emotions of all Muslims are connected to one another. This is the center of love and affection in the world of Islam. Of course, you can witness that in the present time, some authors who are financially supported by the Zionists pay attention to this center and insult it. They do this so that the importance of insulting the Islamic Ummah and humiliating the world of Islam diminishes. This is the main point.
Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.